tonight. It's Sarah from the Northeast Club in Philly.
Hi, I'm Sarah. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Sarah.
I hate these things. I'm really sorry. I want to thank Jack for asking me to come out here and speak tonight. I'm still getting used to people asking me to come speak. I'm usually, spent many years being, kicked out of family functions and asked to leave most places. So this is kind of, it's an honor for me to stand up here for AA. And, I basically come here to just tell in a general way what it was like, what happened, and what it's like today. I do have a sober date. It's May 3rd, 2012. I have a sponsor, and I have a home group, which is the Greater Northeast Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I happen to think it is one of the best places on earth. That place saved my life, and I owe a debt to that place that I can never repay. It's right on the front lines. We're right underneath the L, and there's people crawling, and they're dying every single day. And I don't know. It's just my heart is there, and I love it. So if you're ever in the area and in Philly, please come and support our group. I guess I'll start at the beginning. I was born, I had two loving parents and who were together. I had six brothers and sisters, and I grew up in a very strict religious household. My father was a Presbyterian minister. My mother was very strict. She expected a lot from us, great, perfect grades in school, straight A's, those kinds of things. We had to excel at everything, and from a very young age, I felt very inadequate. I had three older siblings who always seemed to be more talented, more gifted, more intelligent than me. And due to my father's job, he was a minister, and we moved around a lot because of his job. I was always the new kid in school, and I always felt different. Like I had a different accent, different hair, different clothes, and we didn't have a lot of money, so my clothes were generally hand-me-downs from my older siblings, and sometimes church donations. So it was, I never felt right, and it always felt like I had to pretend to be something in order. I remember making up these silly little lies when I was kids, like just to try to get kids to like me. I was talking to a friend of mine the other day. I remember making up this ridiculous lie that I was going to meet Michael Jackson. That I was going to get his autograph. Trying to force his autograph on an album cover because I had to do these things to get people to like me because I just wasn't okay with me. But I was a decent kid. I was a good kid, and mostly because I didn't want to experience any consequences. I lived in a lot of fear. Fear of my parents, fear of what other people thought of me, fear of not being liked and not being accepted. And so I did well in school, and I did what I was told. I had to go to church every Sunday, so the God thing ran down my throat. And, Sunday school, all that good stuff, and I did what I was told. And, bounced around from school to school, always trying to make new friends and, trying to find my niche, went from these weird stages like goth and all these strange things. But, I got to, high school things started to get more and more comfortable because I felt more and more pressure to, try to fit in and be accepted and all. So when I was about 15 years old, and I share this as a part of my story because before I went through these steps, thoroughly and honestly, and actually found out what I suffer from, I really believe that this was the reason I was an alcoholic. At age 15, I went to a party, and I was hanging out with some kids, and they left me there. And I had to walk home through the woods, and on my way home in the woods, I was found by three men who raped me, beat me, and left me for dead. And when I was found and brought to the hospital, my parents were called, and my mother came, and she sat there for about an hour telling me, this is your, what did you do? This is your fault. How could you do this? And, essentially made it my fault. And I'm already a person who's run by fear, but now this is it. I'm fueled by fear, hatred, and resentment now, and I hate everything around me. Nobody can touch me physically, emotionally. I won't. And it was after that I picked up my first drink. Well, I think I'd probably drank there here and there, but it was the first time I realized the effect that alcohol could have on me. It was after that I realized the numbing effect that alcohol and other substances had on me. And This is Alcoholics Anonymous, and I respect this fellowship more than anything. Drugs are a huge part of my story, and I will keep it in the bottle out of respect for the fellowship that's given me back my life. But, so after that happened, I just started putting anything and everything I could in my body just to try to not feel the fear, the pain, and the anger, and the hatred towards everybody around me, specifically these men, especially my mother, more so than anybody on this planet. I felt more victimized by her than I did by the men that did this to me. I felt betrayed, and I wanted no parts of this family. I wanted no parts of... And I also felt like my siblings started treating me differently, and I don't know if that was my brain or if they just were so... They didn't, in shock, and didn't know how to deal with what had happened to me, but it really doesn't matter today. The reality is I use that as an excuse for over 20 years to get loaded. And I found that out finally through doing some thorough work on myself. Like, I ended up running off here. I couldn't go back to school, so of course I dropped out. And I found a bunch of people who were doing exactly what I was doing, a bunch of kids my age who were running around partying, and I started to have fun. Like, I felt free. The alcohol did that for me. Like, I didn't have to be constantly having the nightmares of what happened. I could be a normal kid. I could be a normal teenager. Of course, I had to be completely loaded in order to do that, but I could do it. I did that for a few years, and then, I tried it. Started taking some courses, got my GED, went back to, went to tech school for medical assisting, and I met this man who I wasn't in love with, but he was the first man I would let touch me, and he was physically non-threatening in every way, and he was a good friend. So, of course, I ended up getting pregnant I was 19 years old, and when I had my daughter, and the best idea at the time seemed to be to get married, because I've always thought that if I had these things, these outside circumstances, that I'd be okay. That if I had a husband, if I had a child, if I had something outside of a job, an apartment, a home, that I'd be okay. I wouldn't feel this rage, this hatred, this resentment, this fear that consumed me. So I have this little perfect little household. So I think, I'm married. I have a daughter and who I love to death. And, on the outside, everything appears okay. I'm employable. And I can pay some bills. And, I mentioned that, I had a lot of doctors prescribe me different things to deal with my PTSD. And, of course, like the good alcoholic I am, I take them in a triple, quadruple the amount I'm supposed to. But I still think that I'm, a normal member of society. So about 10 months into our marriage, my husband at the time goes out and gets drunk and comes in with violent rage and decides he wants to. And I could hold jobs. It never really occurred to me that there was something wrong with the fact that I could never stay at a job for longer than, for 6 months to a year. That my partner, it talks about these endeavors that we had trouble in personal relationships and the job. These were things I was experiencing a long time ago. I just didn't recognize them. I just thought it. I could just go from endless stream of jobs and that was still okay. Well, when my daughter was three, my ex-husband, I was having some financial problems. So I asked my ex-husband for some help, and his idea of help would be to take me to court and take primary physical custody of our child, because he had money and he had family support that I did not have. And he won. He beat me. And so basically everything that I had lived for, which was my child, was being taken away from me. And the thing is, she wasn't even really being taken from me. I didn't have her in my home 24/7. But to me, this was just catastrophic. I was losing everything, and I went immediately back to the only solution that I knew, which was to pick up a drink. And I ran off that for several years. Still, I could still get jobs. I still had a roof over my head, And I would bounce around, I would get in these long-term relationships that became more and more abusive over time, and I began to feel less and less about myself, and just all I knew was that when I picked up a drink or other things, that I didn't feel that anymore. I felt okay. When I was about 27 years old, I met another solution in a bar one night, and it seemed perfect. You know, we were going to live happily ever after. That we met that first night, and we didn't leave each other's side for a few weeks, and then about a month and a half in, he pulled out a ring and said, "Will you marry me?" And I said, "This is great. So I can be normal again, and I can have the home and the husband, and I can have the life back." He did not know one true thing about me. Everything I presented to this man was a lie. Like everything. I presented myself as this, like, you know, normal functioning member of society. He didn't question a lot. He just accepted it as face value, because why wouldn't he? I ended up dragging that man through absolute hell. When we were married for about 6 months, I ended up finding out I was pregnant, and this was great, like another outside solution that I can use. Like, I have all these things on the outside. You know, my daughter is, you know, at our house all the time. I have this little family, and now I'm going to have a baby with this man. Everything's perfect. So I started to have some complications and some pain, and I went to the hospital, and they gave me a medication that ended the pregnancy, and they were very apologetic at the time. They acknowledged that it was their fault. So I went. All this, and I just felt internally that I had done something wrong, and I needed to make it right, and I needed to fix this, and I needed to make him happy, and I needed to fix this little life I'd set up for myself. So in this twisted attempt to fix these outward circumstances, I ended up pregnant again 5 weeks later, and I lost my mind. Like, I was out of my mind. During this pregnancy, I didn't stay sober one day. I couldn't eat. I didn't want anything to do with this. I had no connection to this child inside of me. I was in a psych ward twice. Nothing. My son was born 2 pounds, 7 ounces at 6 months. And I remember going to the NICU the first time I laid eyes on him. I fell madly in love with him. And he's in this incubator, and he has all these tubes. And I remember seeing him for the first time and falling just so deeply in love with him, but knowing that it was my actions, everything I had done, had put him where he was. I had made him that sick. And there was no way I could deal with that. There was no way I could deal with guilt and shame. And all my lies were exposed. Like, this man, you know, through the hospitalizations, through my pregnancy, had begun to see what he had gotten himself into, what I truly was, this monster that I had become. And, you know, the downward spiral came very quickly, and by the time my son was 8 months old, my husband was getting a call from the police station saying, "You need to take your wife, or your son, because we're locking your wife up," and she had your son in the car. And he left, as he should, as he should have. I mean, no father should ever have to receive that phone call, and, you know, I spent the night in jail, and he came home to an empty apartment, and I was devastated. By this time, my first husband had already started to see the road I was heading, and he had started to pull my daughter, you know, back from my life a little bit. And so basically everyone is trying to back away from me at this point, because they see this destructive path I'm on. And when I came home to that apartment, all their things gone, and I just wanted to die. There was nothing left to live for. Every outward solution that I had in my life was gone. And I had nothing. I was left with just me, and I could not deal with just me. I've never dealt with just me. So for about a month and a half, almost 2 months, I got into bed, and I basically did nothing but drink, you know, and for lack of a better word for what I was doing, and I did not eat anything. At the end of this 2 months, my mother showed up at my apartment. I was 75 pounds. I had a fever of 106. I was taken to the ICU, had a heart infection, multiple blood infections, needed blood transfusions, the whole 9 yards. And, they told my mother, she will not live the night. And, you know, to this, like, now, after certain things that have happened since I've been sober, like, to knowing that I've done that to this woman, I don't know, there's certain things that I have a difficult time forgiving myself for, and that's one of them, and knowing the agony I put everybody through. But for some reason, you know, I see it now today as God, of course, but at the time I had no idea why. 2 weeks later I wake up and I'm still in the ICU and I'm alive, because this is not where I want to be. I don't want to be alive. After a month in the ICU, I get transferred to a skilled nursing facility, which is essentially a nursing home, and I can't walk anymore. My muscles have atrophied. I have to have physical therapy. And you know, the most insidious part of this disease is the entire time I was in, 5 months in the nursing facility, I injected alcohol of some form into a line in my port, surgically put in my chest. I had no desire to be sober, none whatsoever. It didn't matter that I was told that I was supposed to die. It didn't matter. I did not want to live. Or I certainly didn't want to live sober, I'll tell you that much, because that never felt right. Well, after that, you know, I left the hospital. Nobody really wanted me. I bounced around from place to place, you know, couch to couch. You know, whoever would take me in, basically. And, you know, and I would be able to put my life together, you know, for bits and pieces, mostly by manipulating some guy into letting me into their life and ripping through his life. That's the truth. And I started getting locked up for more and more charges. I don't get misdemeanors for some reason. I get felonies. And to this date, I have 11 felonies. And four of them are first degree. And, you know, I like burglaries and access device fraud and anything I needed to do to, like, you know, keep drinking. So, you know, I would go into jail and I would be in that cell and I'd be like, there's no way I can do this again. Like, I've got to change my life. I've got to get my kids back. I've got to do this. And I'd have all these great ideas of, like, how I was going to fix things. This is what I'm going to do when I get out. And every idea, I would leave there and, like, with it, maybe I'd hold it together for a week, maybe a month, maybe a day. It didn't matter. Eventually I'd drink again. And that kept happening. And so after one of my incarcerations, I got sent to a halfway house in Delaware County. And there was a requirement there that we had to make 5 meetings a week. So I, of course, chose always the easiest way. And I found a little AA clubhouse, you know, a few blocks down the road, 7109. I believe it's still there. And I would go there every day to get this sheet signed off on. And it was a bunch of old men chain smoking in a room. And I really, really believed that AA was a place where you go to, like, bitch about your problems until you die. And I really wanted no parts of it. Like, this, I was like, this is awful. Like, just sign this shit and, like, let me go. And that's what I did. Like, I did nothing. And you know, just because I was staying sober, like, things were starting to happen. Like, my life was getting a little better. You know, you know, we're talking, like, this is 6 years later. 6 years of in and out of institutions, jails, and you know, my second husband's now remarried. And my son's being raised by another woman, and I'm in and out of his life. I'm in and out of my daughter's life. But this time I go and I you know, put everything down, and I show up at these meetings, and I hang around a few good people. And I work. I become obsessed about making money. That's my solution then. I, like, if I make a ton of money, and if I, you know, I fit do my 90 days in the halfway house, and I get my place, and I have all this money stacked up, and I have visitation rights with my son. And, you know, my daughter's back in my life, and everything's perfect. And then I went to a lacrosse game with my daughter and my son, and my daughter was playing out on the field, and my 6-year-old son said to me, "No, you're not my real mom. Kim's my real mom because she takes care of me every day, and you just gave birth to me." And I felt like somebody literally stabbed me in the heart. Like, I was like, probably, maybe those weren't his words, they probably weren't. He could not have been more accurate with that statement. I have never been a mother to that little boy. Needless to say, I was found later on that night OD'd on the floor of my apartment by my landlord. And, you know, of course, because he had some random reason to come in my apartment and fix something. No idea, like, that God is showing up all these times in my life, like, for some reason, I'm not supposed to be dead at that point, and I have to keep living, which at that point seems like the worst possible fate, is that I just have to keep living. And, you know, once again, I go on another year-long run after that. And because of that year-long run, I cannot continue to go to court and see my son anymore because I have warrants out for my arrest and I cannot pass the urine. And, you know, I lost my son, essentially. Like, to this day, that was about 9 years ago now. I still have not been enough. And, I'll get to that towards the end. Like, but So for years I spend doing this, like in and out. Each time I get locked up, it's longer, and you know, each time I get out, I do the exact same thing. So a few years ago, I get locked up, and I get out, and nobody wants me. Shocking, nobody wants me in their home at all, and I have nowhere to go, and somebody suggests I go to a recovery house in Northeast Philadelphia. And I know nothing of Northeast Philadelphia, this little place called Frankfort. I know a lot about Northwest, but nothing about Northeast. And so I go there, and I go to this house, and I'm the model client. I obey all the rules, and I go to the meetings, and I get once again, I have to get that checklist. You know, I got to make those mandatory meetings. But in this house, I'm told I have to get a sponsor, which is a little different. I get a sponsor who, in name only, essentially, and I, you know, maybe write down a couple things on a piece of paper, then call that a fourth step. I don't know. And I did basically no work, half measures. I don't even think I did quarter measures, but I just made a lot of friends and, you know, flirted with a lot of guys and manipulated a lot of people and was dishonest. I mean, I was even shoplifting. Like, I had zero, I was really crazy in AA, and I would come in the rooms every day and still be an awful human being. So sitting in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous for this alcoholic does not work. Meeting makers, all that, hungry, angry, lonely, tired, I have to watch it. You know what? None of that shit matters to an alcoholic like me. If I don't do these 12 steps, and if I don't seek God and do what the big book tells me to do, then I'm going to drink. And even when I'm not drinking, I'm going to cause a lot of harm. Well, of course, I met another solution while I was living at this house, and he had a year sober, and you know, he was living still at a recovery house, probably like court stipulated there or something, and I was like, this is it, we're madly in love, let's move in together in 3 weeks. So I think that, you know, my ideas are awesome at the time, and so we're living together for about a month, and you know, he's got this whole, you know, he's jealous, he doesn't want me going to meetings because there might be another guy looking at me, and so eventually I just stopped going to meetings altogether. And then I go to work one day, and my boss wants to be really inappropriate with me, and I walk off the job, and a few hours later, I'm getting CPR brought back to life. So that was the beginning of my last run, and it was the shortest run of my life. Usually, my runs last over a year, but this one was a little over a month, and it was the most painful. Just brought me, like, and it wasn't even the thing, because at the end of the run, I still had stuff. I had a roof over my head, I had a car, I had a job. Internally, I was dying, and I remember my last night out there, I remember grabbing my car keys, like, quietly, so I could sneak out and go get my alcohol without waking him up, so I could share. And it was about 4:30 in the morning, and I grabbed my keys, and I'm in my car, and I'm driving to Kensington, and, I don't want to be doing this, and I can't stop. So for the first time in my life, I screamed out to the God, and it was the most, like, I've said a lot of prayers in my life. I've said, please get me out of jail. Please let, you know, this detainer get lifted, like those kind of prayers. But never in my life did I scream out to God like this, because I had been, I was dying inside, and I knew it. And I said, dear God, please just fucking kill me or stop me, because I can't. Like, that's what I screamed at. I was screaming and beating on the steering wheel. And so 12 hours later, I got locked up on a summary retail theft. Like, the only minor charge I've ever had in my life. And I, you know, God shows up in a lot, in people's lives in a lot of ways for some reason. He always shows up. And today I see it. See how amazing that is. I mean, it's very unpleasant at the time, and I went in kicking and screaming. I'm like, I'm going to beat this. They don't really have any evidence on me. It's only a summary. They're not going to give me. Except when you have 11 felonies and you've been on probation for your whole life almost, they don't look kindly even on a summary retail theft. So they sent me, you know, to jail, and they violated me. And 10 months, after 10 months of being in jail, I went before a judge who said, I'm sentencing you to 1 to 3 years in the state correctional facility. And I think my heart almost stopped beating. Like, because this is a person completely driven by fear. I've been afraid of everything. So I'm scared out of my mind to go to Muncie. Like, the word Muncie just terrified me. I couldn't even imagine it. And I got sent. And I went upstate. And So I'm in classification. And the only two ways I can get out of my cell is if I go to AA. All I have is this Sally who just cries incessantly all day long. All she wants to do is go home. And she won't shut up. And she listens to country music. And I'm like, So I'm like, please, I need to get out of here. And I don't want to go to church because I'm really pissed off at God because God put me in place, but I'll go to AA. I can deal with that. And I go to AA and I see these, like nothing huge happened. You know, I don't even remember what was said. I remember seeing these people, like these happy people who were taking time out of their lives. And they were like coming into this facility and they were sharing their experience, strength and hope in us. And you know what planted that little seed? And I reached out to someone. It came time to parole, and I reached out. Like, no, once again, nobody wanted me, and no one was going to let me home to land at their house. So I sent a letter to the woman in Frankfurt who had let me stay there before. She said, absolutely. And eventually, after 18 months of walked away, they sent me to wherever they were going. Got there, and I had all these great ideas, and I had great plans for my life. This is what I was going to do. I'm going to get out, and I'm going to do 30 days at this recovery house, and I'm going to fix this broken relationship with this guy who like cheated on me all the time, and loved me, and done all this stuff. We're going to get a couple's recovery house. I mean, it was sick, twisted. Like, this is how my mind was working. And I got home, and like, all my plans got smashed. Like, I saw this man for who he was, and every idea, every external thing had been ripped away from me. Every article of clothing that I had had been taken from me. I was wearing donations again to figure, like, back to square one. And like 18 months, I haven't drank anything in my system, and I'm at this recovery house, and I don't have a relationship to fall back on, and I don't, like, I'm on blackout, and I can't see my kid, and there's nothing but me, and me, just me, again, and what do I do again? I cry out to God, because every night, I'm curled up in a ball, and I want to die, and I'm stupid. So what the fuck is wrong with me, right? Anyway, I had been around AA before, and I'd seen all these people coming around, and they were happy, and they had a light in them. And frankly, I thought they were all full of shit. I really did. I was like, there was no way they suffered. There's no way they were as bad an alcoholic as me. There's no way. And but this time around, God placed the most amazing thing in my life. He placed people who I'd seen out there, like who I was running with, who, like, people I'd seen broken. And these people were walking around AA, and they were big. And they had a light about them, and they were glowing. And I wanted that. I didn't want to be anymore. I didn't start doing this stuff because I thought I was going to be AA. I don't think anybody does that. I don't think anybody even comes to AA because it's, oh, great, this is really what I want for my life. I did it because I was in so much pain that it made me willing to do whatever it took to not suffer anymore. So I asked this girl who was significantly younger than me, and we have nothing in common. Like, nothing. I asked her, please help me. And she did. Because that's what AA tells you to do. And I remember when I got to the first step. Like, I have no problem admitting I'm a drug addict. That's pretty evident. Like, it is the alcohol that I've been in for many years. I used to get resentful just saying the word alcoholic. Like, I could always just pick up one. Never realizing that it began with alcohol, and it went back to alcohol over and over and over again. And alcohol led me right back to the other thing. And when I finally, like, really, like, sat down with this woman and she told me what I suffered from, I knew it. I conceded to my innermost self what I was for the first time in my life. I did that. And the came to believe was so, like, I had already come to believe because I'd seen the evidence in these people around me, these people who were living on the corner of Kensington and Somerset, who were walking around AA with God. And that was my came to believe. And my third step, like, I really had a lot of God issues. Like, the God I was supposed to believe in growing up was like this, you know, Presbyterian God. And, you know, here are the Ten Commandments, which I've broken all but one. And, I'm going to hell, and I'm going to be punished, and I don't want any part of that God. And I was told I could pick my own God concept, and that was everything to me. And initially, my God concept was so tiny that it was just the 12 steps and the people around me who were doing the deal, and I followed them. Because I knew my will was so screwed up that every time I followed my will, something really awful happened, and I ended up suffering. So for once in my life, I was like, you know what, I'm going to do what somebody else tells me to do. And initially, that was the only God concept I have. That's totally different than I sat down, I put pen to paper, and I wrote out that fourth step, and I got gut-level honest. like, so honest that it's sickening, and I'll admit it today, I hit 26 pages of resentment. Because I thought that was the best part. I'm like, yay, I get to write down everybody I'm pissed off at. And my sponsor's like, are you kidding me? But that's how sick I was. Like, it was everybody else's fault. Like, it was my mother's fault. She did this to me, right? It was those men. It was every bad thing that happened to me. I was a victim the whole life. If these girls at school had been my friend, this is how my sick brain works. And, my sponsor didn't tell me I was raped because of anything I did. She didn't tell me any of that nut shit. Like, I've heard people hear you, but what she told me was, is you take this one event in your life and you ran with that and you made yourself a victim. And you used that as your excuse and you used this resentment and you harmed your mother over and over again over this one thing she did. And here's the hardest part of it is I had to, I found out some things about my mom and about the abuse that she grew up with and the horrible alcoholic abuse that she was raised in. And, this woman sat with me and helped me see things from a totally different perspective and helped me see my part in things. And, six and seven at the time were so, it's so easy to do six and seven when you're completely broken, let me tell you. Because you're like, please, God, have all of me. Just take it because today it's a little different. Ego steps in and it's a little harder to have because I still think that, I'm doing something. And I'm really not. But at that time, when I was told, immediately, I did my hour and was told to do six and seven. And that's how it was done for me. And I did that. And I was broken. I was like, take this broken person. And you do what you need to do here. And then I had to go out and make these amends. And listen, my family, everybody I knew was sick of amends. They didn't, I mean, not amends because I'd never made them, but they were sick of sorry. I've always said sorry. I've said it to everybody. And nobody wanted to hear it. Not my child. My daughter, who absolutely adores me for some unknown reason to this day, and I'm coming up on 4 years sober, has still never heard my amends. She's never heard the declaration. She hasn't had to. She's lived it. She lives it. And so I went out and I went and I remember going to make the amends to my mother, and I remember being all torn up inside, and I even wrote out this stuff, and I'm like, this is what I'm going to say. And I remember my sponsor said, you have to pray before you do this one. And I did, and I remember I prayed, and then all of a sudden, I just all poured out, and it was like, everything I had done wrong to her, it didn't matter what she'd ever done to me, it was everything I had done to her, and I felt it in my heart that I was wrong, and I didn't say, I'm sorry, forgive me, I said, I was wrong, how can I make this right? And, of course, she put some outrageous thing, like, be a living example to your brother who's suffering from this disease. Like, something that I attempt to live up to every day, but I fall short of constantly. And then I went to go, my oldest sister, Amy, she and I had, one of the worst relationships, growing up for many, many years. And the saddest part about it was Amy and I were so much alike. We both kind of had these same isms throughout our lives, and then we ended up having a lot of the same problems with food, eating disorder issues and things like that. I remember I made the approach to her. She'd been sick for a few years, and, because she had a similar spiritual malady that we suffer from, but hers had to do with food. Like, her anorexia, had her bedridden. And I reached out to her, and our big book says that, when you make the amends, feuds and longstanding sometimes fall away, and this is what happened. My sister, when I made the amends, poured her heart out to me about everything she had done wrong, and she became my best friend in the whole world. We talked about everything, and she told me the deepest, darkest secrets of her soul, and we did the same, and she finally told me she felt like she had a friend, and for a year and a half, I had my sister back, and I had not only that as one of my best friends in the world, and so about 8 months ago, my mom called and told me she died, and to this day, till the day I die, I'll never forget the sound of my mother's voice when I picked up the phone that morning. I felt this woman's pain from several states away, like the agony in her voice that her daughter was dead. And it says in the promises that we will intuitively know how to handle situations that used to baffle us. I intuitively knew to call a friend of mine in AA who just lost his father and ask him for help. He intuitively knew to tell me to call every member of my family and ask them what they needed, because this wasn't about me. I didn't make it about me. I went to the funeral. I had the honor of standing there when my mother saw her daughter in the casket for the first time and holding this woman who I hated my whole life and comforting her. And, you know, AA gave that to me. I, on my own power, cannot do that, because if I had not made these amends and if I had not had a God in my life, I would never have been able to walk in that room with my siblings, with my sister in a casket, with my parents. And, you know, her husband even came to thank me and said, your friendship meant everything to her. And, so, you know, I came home, and then, like, here's the thing, like, I, for the first time in my life, I was feeling pain, and, you know, I had several people in AA, like, I had already started, at that time, like, thank God, you know, I already had a program in my life when this did happen, you know, I had already, started on 10, 11, and 12, like, I'd already been working those, and, you know, I had a, I didn't have a lot of sponsees, but I had been pretty thorough about working 10 and 11. I really didn't have the God thing down. I knew I was seeking God, and I'll tell you one thing. There's nothing that will make you seek God more than grief and pain. And, so what I did was I threw myself into AA, because people were just like, other people who had experienced these kind of things knew better than me, and they would throw women to help my way. And I didn't know what I was doing, and I just threw myself into AA, and this 11th step started really taking off, like, because I knew that I had to grow in this area, like my spirituality had to be firmer and stronger, because it says for the low spots ahead. Like, the low spots happened this year. Like, people talk about, like, the first year of sobriety being the hardest. But the second, you know, I'm coming. This is my fourth year, and this year has been the hardest of my life. The hardest because I've experienced it sober. And, you know, because I've made many decisions based on self, because, of course, like, the good alcoholic I am, like, after I'd gone through my steps. And, you know, I thought my judgment had gotten a little better. I entered in another relationship, of course, and, you know, for this past year, he has not been able to stay sober. So, you know, and I've been living, as of, you know, this weekend, I was living with an active alcoholic for a year. And, you know, I was talking with someone. I went to an Al-Anon meeting this weekend, just, you know, I was at the Roundup. And, you know, I try to grow in all areas of my life. And I realized for a long time and over this year that I could trust God to keep me sober in all areas of my life. Like, I was stagnant in my job, and I was feared up about getting a new job, and I talked to God about it, and, you know, opportunities came up, and I, you know, paused, and I prayed, and God, you know, helped me take the steps I needed to make to get out of that job. But for some reason, I could do it in all areas of my life, but when it came to this relationship, and whether he could stay sober or not, I couldn't trust God. I became agnostic when it came to him. I was like, I can trust you in all areas of my life. I can trust you to get and keep me sober. I can trust you to get me through the hardest thing I ever went through. But I can't trust you to work this out for him in your time. And and coming to the realization that I was still playing God to that level was really hard. You know, I agonized this over the year. I'll tell you one thing, though. No matter what happened this year, between that, you know, my other things, like my cat died, I had a car accident. All of this happened in the last year, but not once, you know, at any time did the thought of drinking or anything else enter my mind. And that's a miracle. Because I'm, you know, 42 years old today, and I've spent the better part of my life obsessing. Like, with that obsession, and today that obsession has been removed. These promises the book talks about have come true. And, you know, I finally, like, had been enough, you know, I finally reached out to people in another fellow, in Al-Anon, because I didn't know what I was doing, and was able to make the steps to, like, separate from this relationship. And, you know, I on any given day, don't know what I'm doing. Like, I really, on every day, I don't know what I'm doing. I get up in the morning, and I, you know, upon awakening, I say that prayer. And then when I get up and I run out the door because I'm too busy to say upon awakening, you know, basically, God, run this show, I feel it, and everybody else around me feels it. And I do know today that I have been given promises that are beyond anything I can imagine. I know everybody is like, oh, you know, I didn't understand that beyond my wildest dreams, because my wildest dreams are I want, you know, millions of dollars, and I want to look like a supermodel, and I want to really, like, my wildest dreams turned out to be like this peace of mind and have nothing to do with stuff or anything external. My wildest dreams turned out to be that my best friend in the world is my 22-year-old daughter, who texts me all day, every day, about absolutely nothing, tells me everything about her life, whether I want to hear it or not, and a relationship with my family that, you know, I have my brother, 2 weeks after my sister died, my brother's in the ICU with respiratory failure, like, and he's out there in this, like. You know, years ago, a friend of mine said to me when my brother was struggling really bad, because honestly, when my mom called that morning about my sister and she sounded like that, I thought she was going to tell me my brother died. And, you know, he's every day texting me this insanity, like, and I get it, the selfishness, that's the core of our disease, and I have to sit there and pray because I can't come at him from this moral and spiritual hilltop, like, you know, like, how can you not be like me? Like, I don't even know, because the hardest part about this is it's like the ones closest to us, the ones we love the most, seem to be the ones that we can't help. We can't talk to about this. I don't know. Years ago, a friend of mine told me, he's like, you know what? You may be the only big book your brother ever sees. So live like that every day. And I really do attempt to. And I really do fall short in... I fail constantly, but I do know that I have a solution today that has nothing to do with a man, has nothing to do with alcohol, has nothing to do with a job, a car, an apartment, has nothing to do with any of those things, and it's amazing, and my life is amazing because of it. You know, I mentioned that I hadn't seen my son in 9 years, and I need to talk about this. Like, I've been looking for him. I know where he lives. You know, this is the one thing. Like, normally I would come back and I would get sober and I'd be like, I need to see my son. It's my turn. Like, I'm back. I'm sober. Mommy's home. And you know, because of there's truly a God in my life today, I know that's wrong. So, you know, I do want to see him, and for a long time I didn't know whether he was okay, and you know, I was struggling with it, and I'd made the approach for the amends to his father, and because I don't want to go directly to him because that might cause harm, and you know, 2 years ago when I made that amends, I was ignored, and I wrote out this long letter of like what I was doing to make my life better, and you know, I said some things I did wrong, but it was more self-serving than anything else. So recently, I realized that amends hadn't been done properly and that I hadn't really put my heart into it enough. And I finally wrote down this amends letter of, like, pages of, like, the wrongs I had caused, and with no ulterior motive of whether I'm going to see him or if not talking about how spiritual or great I am, nothing, and I sent that out. And I felt, like, truly that feeling of, like, that, you know, it's unfortunate that a lot of people will not hear our amends, and that is the reality of it. We've done enough harm where people will not respond and they will not hear us. But there is that freedom that comes with the cleaning our side of the street. And recently, you know, I every few months I would go on social media and I would go look for my son because he's, you know, 15 now, so that makes sense that he would be out there. And I never was able to find him, and then a couple weeks ago I was doing my, like, I guess, quarterly review of, like, all social media, and he had a girlfriend who made a joke account, and his name showed up on it. And I saw my son. I saw his face. And he's happy. He's really, really happy. He's a runner, and he's doing 5Ks, and he has a normal, everyday life. And how dare I? How dare I walk into that child's life and say, hey, he's sober now. Let's have a relationship. It's my turn. And it's not my turn. It's my turn when God says it's my turn. And I truly believe that in my heart today. I'm not sitting up here saying AA has made me the super spiritual person, that I don't feel pain, that I don't miss him, that I don't, you know, but... AA has granted me that acceptance, and that things do work out on God's time, and that I don't have to, like, force the issue. I feel like I was given that gift, that little glimpse into his life, to see that he's happy and that he's loved. I don't know if anything I said here tonight made a difference to anybody. I really don't. And you know, I most of the time don't know what the hell I'm talking about. You know, I love that set-aside prayer. Like, I really don't know anything. I'm amazed. I see these people around me who, like, walk with that book under their arm, and they quote it like it's it. And I really learn something constantly from people. It doesn't matter if they have a day sober, a second sober, 30 years. I just learn. And I want to continue learning. I want to continue growing. The second I start feeling comfortable in AA, I know I'm screwed. And I don't know. AA has given me a life beyond anything I could possibly imagine, and I'm truly grateful. That's all I have.